Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, as the annual week of prayer for Christian unity draws to a close, the president of the Pontifical Council for Promoting That Unity explains its added significance in this Pauline year. How did the week of prayer first start, and how can the faithful get involved? And Pope Benedict will mark the end of the week of prayer on the feast of the conversion of St. Paul this Sunday. Who was this apostle, and where is he buried in Rome? It's been a week of meetings and prayer encounters for Christians across the spectrum, all aiming at finding ways to overcome the obstacles to uniting all of the common faith's many churches. For those who have been participating here in Rome, Pope Benedict will preside solemn vespers in the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls on Sunday to mark the end of the week of prayer. But as the president of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, Cardinal Walter Kasper, points out, it takes on added significance in this Pauline year.
Oh, yes, very much so, because St. Paul spoke in his letters a lot about the unity of the church and about the scandal of divisions. And he told us also, or tells us also, that it's the Holy Spirit, it's Christ himself, which is the center of unity. It's not an organizational problem to unite two bodies as you unite two businesses, which happens often in our globalized world. It's a spiritual thing, and Sister St. Paul can tell us, and St. Paul is also a common basis we have, especially with the Lutheran Christians, who the letters of St. Paul are very important for them. So I think the Pauline year has a special meaning and importance this year.
Each day of the week of prayer focuses on a specific theme, suggesting ways and giving ideas about how people can get involved in the dialogue. So, how can churches draw inspiration from these themes?
It's very important. Ecumenism is not only a thing on the top level. It's especially, in a special way, a question of the grassroots level of every Christian, Catholic or not Catholic. It can take in many ways. It can take by praying. That's the most important thing. And it can also sacrifice his suffering if he is sick and so on. With people who he meets every day, he can give witness of his Christian faith, invites them to come together. He can read the Bible together with other Christians, so as they can also take part on some occasions of other churches or church communities. There are so many possibilities to do something for ecumenism, and not least we produce such documents, but they are not produced to put them in shelves. They should be read, they should be received at the grassroots level. And also this can be done on the parish level or on the diocesan level. There are many events now which can help to bring people together and to create a new climate, a new atmosphere, and to overcome old prejudices.
Cardinal Walter Kasper is president of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. For almost a century, in the month of January, a growing number of Christians from denominations across the board have set aside a week of prayer for Christian unity, an initiative that began with a group of Episcopalian Catholic religious in the United States. They chose January 18th to the 25th, the week in which we celebrate feast days of the saints Peter and Paul, the apostles revered by all Christians.
From its very earliest days, the Church in Rome remembers the 18th of January as the feast of the Cathedra Petri, the feast of the chair of Peter, the day on which the Apostle Peter first led a service with the faithful in Rome. It's also the day set aside to recall Peter's confession of belief. January the 25th celebrates the feast of the conversion of St. Paul. The two feasts mark the great moments of truth for the two apostles in fully accepting God's will. At Caesarea Philippi, when Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" St. Peter replied, "You are the Messiah." And on the road to Damascus, St. Paul was blinded when Christ appeared to him and forever changed his life into one of spreading the good news.
The week of prayer for Christian unity was the brainchild of Episcopalian Reverend Lewis Watson, who, together with Sister Lorana White, in the early 1900s formed a new religious community within the Episcopalian Church in New York, following the Franciscan rule of life. Watson chose as his new religious name Father Paul James Francis. Well, after years of intense ecumenical work advocating the reunification of Christian churches, Father Paul and Mother Lurana decided to enter the Catholic Church. In 1909, their Society of the Atonement was received into the Roman Catholic Church, the first religious community to do so since the 16th century Reformation. Each year, the theme and the text for the Week of Prayer are chosen and prepared by representatives of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity and representatives of the World Council of Churches.
It began as an outreach among Anglo-Catholics because the Society of the Atonement was founded in the Episcopal Church, USA, as a Franciscan community at Graymore in Garrison, New York.
Father James Lockeren is the director of the Society of the Atonement's Graymore Ecumenical and Interreligious Institute in New York. He sums up for us how the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity has developed since its conception by the co-founder of his order in 1908.
In the end of the 19th century, in 1898, as a movement of men and women, really, in the Anglican Church who sought unity with the Roman Catholic Church, very simply, they believed that there was some process by which Anglicans and Roman Catholics could come together to reunite into one community. It was very naive in a way, but also very faith-filled. They believed that this would be a work of the Holy Spirit, and Father Paul Watson, the founder of the Friars of the Atonement, would often go to various Episcopal churches to preach this idea of reunion, as he called it, with Rome. And his message was not very well received. And so he began to develop a magazine called The Lamp Magazine, first published in 1903, while still an Anglican. And he used that as a vehicle to promote what he called at that time Christian unity or reunionism. In the process, he befriended an Anglican priest named Spencer Jones in England, who was also in the Anglo-Catholic movement, and wanted to set aside a day a year to pray for the unity of the church. And so Father Paul Watson responded, wouldn't it be better to use the traditional octave, 8 days of prayer? And so he thought perhaps January 18th to 25th would be good, because on our older calendar, January 18th was the Feast of the Chair of Peter, and the 25th is still the Feast of the Conversion of Paul. And so Spencer Jones agreed, and Father Paul, through his Lamp magazine, began to promote the idea around 1907, and in 1908 they actually celebrated in January the first Church Unity Octave, as it was called then, at Graymore.
By 1909, the idea had become a tradition, one picked up by churches across Europe. It gained impetus, though, through one of the most famous events in Vatican history.
It was in October of 1909, after the second week of prayer for Christian unity, which was, I should say, called the Church Unity Octave, that Father Paul and the foundress, Mother Lorena, and the other friars and sisters of the Atonement became Roman Catholics. They were corporately welcomed into the Catholic Church by Pope Pius X and put under the care of the Archdiocese of New York at the time. Over the years, as the friars grew in the Catholic Church, the commitment to pray for the unity of the Church continued. However, since this was before the Second Vatican Council, the Church Unity Octave focused on praying for the return of other Christians to the fullness of communion with the Catholic Church. And so it became, in a sense, a prayer by Catholics for the other Christians to come into full communion with the Catholic Church. After the Second Vatican Council, things began to change, of course, with Lumen Gentium and then, of course, the Decree on Ecumenism, so that we could begin to pray together with other Christians that the unity of the Church would come about as Christ wills it, which, of course, was the founding principle of Christian unity prayer in Europe at the time as well. So by Father Paul Couturier and others who started that movement in the 1920s to pray for the unity of the Church ecumenically rather than in a sort of one-directional type of thing.
The Society of the Atonement works to promote Christian unity across the U.S., Asia, and Europe. Here in Rome, their activities are centered at the Centro Pro Unione. Well, Sister Lorelei Fuchs herself has been on the forefront of ecumenical efforts towards unity. She explains that while the dialogue can differ from country to country and culture to culture, it's something that affects us all.
I think if we look at the United States, we're in a very unique situation here because we live very ecumenically, unlike, say, many countries in Europe, like Italy, for example, that we're rubbing shoulders with other Protestants, other Christians, Protestants, Orthodox, as well as the whole interreligious Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Sikhs. Everybody's on the subway with you when you come to work here. In terms of dialogue, though, I think one of the things that's an asset for us here is that we try in the United States, the churches, to have dialogues at all levels. So, of course, there is the highest level of international dialogues, which, again, the Roman Catholic Church has been in the forefront of bilateral relations of that nature. There's also national dialogues, each country having a dialogue, and the United States is in the forefront of that as well. But then there's also local dialogue. So, for example, regionally in the New York area, which then goes to either the synod or the dioceses of the different churches, I'm personally involved in the local ARC dialogue, Anglican Roman Catholic. There's a local Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue, and then the Lutheran Episcopal dialogue locally. And I think it's the local that sometimes becomes more important in some ways than the national or the international, because that's where the grassroots understanding and reception of the message for the unity of the Church and the unity of Christians comes about. So it's an advantage by the fact that it's happening on various levels and various fronts.
Sister Fuchs believes in getting the ecumenical message to the people in the pews. So what does she think the faithful can do to take a convincing step towards unity in their own local communities?
I think a tremendous effort that could be made, or a step that could be made, is that, and some dioceses in this country have done this, synods and other groups, that at certain levels, including the local congregational level, have a point person, have somebody responsible to lift up what is happening ecumenically, and to kind of do the ecumenical possible, not the ecumenical impossible. I think sometimes we set up goals too hard to reach. So, for example, something very practical. In a Catholic parish, have a PER, a parish ecumenical representative, who at the parish council will inform and be informed about things happening in the churches, like if there is a dialogue text that's issued. So to find out what's happening, or to even, for example, lift up who are the other churches besides the Roman Catholic Church in your area, to know who is the Methodist around the corner or the Presbyterian down the road, and what collaborative efforts could be done as Christians together, for example, sharing a soup kitchen or a crop walk or things like that. I think also, just like on a parish council, there'd be somebody who's concerned about the worship of the parish. What about at the worship on Sunday mornings at Mass, including the intercessions, a church in the locale, and pray for that church as well? So I think there's a lot of little steps we can do that we kind of lose sight of. The Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul, January 25th, marks the end of the week of prayer for Christian unity. Ecumenical celebrations on that day are traditionally held each year at the Rome Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls, not far west from the Vatican. Well, centuries ago, the original basilica was built over the tomb of the Apostle Paul. While Peter's burial place can be seen underneath St. Peter's Basilica, the Apostle Paul's had been hidden from view. But after recent excavations beneath St. Paul's Basilica, pilgrims can finally catch a glimpse of the Apostle's tomb. The rough-hewn marble sarcophagus dates back to the time of Constantine in the 4th century and has been buried in concrete and under tons of rubble beneath the basilica. Well, I asked Professor of Christian Art and Architecture Elizabeth Lev why the Basilica of St. Paul's is called Outside the Walls, and how Paul came to live and die here in Rome.
Because the name of the church comes from the fact that the basilica is built outside of the ancient Roman city walls. In 271, Rome had a series, today you can still see this intact series of walls, which spans an 11-mile circuit. The Rome of Paul's age in the 60s was an even smaller circuit of walls. And the Church of St. Paul, when it was eventually built by Constantine, was built outside the city walls on the site where St. Paul had been buried, and so it's referred to as the Church of St. Paul outside the walls, whereas there are churches to St. Paul within the city walls.
It's quite symbolic, too, it seems to me, that both St. Peter's and St. Paul's are on the same side of the Tiber River.
In both cases, I think even more interesting is the way they are spread directly opposite from each other. So if the Romans always construct their cities with what they call the Cardo and the Decumanus, these are two main roads, so they're the lifeline, and there's this intersection between the two roads. The churches of St. Peter and St. Paul, they make really the Cardo of Rome, the two balances that define and shape the city. And so it is a very interesting aspect of the construction.
Now, why would St. Paul's bones have been buried there. What kind of a life did he have in Rome? We know the story, especially from Caravaggio's painting in Santa Maria del Popolo, of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, who is blinded by the revelation of God. Tell us more about the life of St. Paul and how he must have lived here in Rome.
Well, St. Paul's conversion was extraordinary in every way. He went from being one of the harshest persecutors of Christians. He was a Jew. He was also a Roman citizen, though, by nature of his birth. He was freeborn as a Roman citizen, which will give him opportunities and possibilities which will not be available to St. Peter, who is not a Roman citizen. And St. Paul started our first mention of Paul is with his earlier name of Saul, persecutor of Christians, eager to go to Damascus to bring other Christians for punishment and persecution. And God's interruption in his life, Christ's revelation to him, and Saul, why do you persecute me? Blinded, helped, assisted, reborn, if you will, he becomes Paul, and he travels all over the Mideast. He goes up through the Hellenistic world. He goes to Greece. He goes to Anatolia. He goes from place to place, forming these pockets of Christians. And then he comes to Rome. And he comes to Rome as a prisoner, because when Paul was brought up for trial, when he was condemned, Paul, as a Roman citizen, had the right of appeal directly to the Roman emperor, which is exactly what plays right into the hands of the Christian plan to bring Christianity to Rome. So Paul was brought to Rome. At the time, according to the legends, the Emperor Nero was not overly interested in the problem of the Christians yet. And so Paul lived in a kind of house arrest in rented rooms for about 2 years, during which time he was able to freely communicate, evangelize, preach. Whether or not he took trips from Rome, things start to get shaky. So we know that Paul lived, he lived at least 2 years here in Rome, because it's in the Acts of the Apostles. There are a number of different areas in Rome that claim, you know, Paul slept here, but we know he lived in rented lodgings, and that Paul was able to, from Rome, he wrote several of his letters, and of course before he came to Rome, he wrote the longest of his letters, which is the letter to the Romans.
Am I correct in recalling that there is a site in the Roman Forum that used to be a prison, and some of the apostles were held there?
Paul's life here in Rome, gradually the net grew closer as Nero's madness grew deeper. The catalyst, according to tradition, was the Great Fire of Rome. And tradition has it that,
which was in the, what, 50s?
64 A.D., mm-hmm. There was the Great Fire of Rome, which knocked out 10 of the 14 quarters of the city. The rumors that flew at the time were that Nero himself had set the fire because he wanted to build in the area. But Nero turned around and blamed the Christians for the fire. And this is documented. Tacitus tells us that that Nero claimed the fire was set by these pernicious Christians, this Jewish cult that followed a man named Crestos. So we see that the Christians are really they're in line for the first major persecution in Rome. Now, the tradition is that St. Peter and St. Paul were both in Rome in 64. As a matter of fact, we think that Paul came to Rome somewhere 60, 62, and that Peter had already been in Rome for many years after he left Antioch. And so that Peter and Paul were rounded up in the repercussions for the fire, and they were put in prison together, in the political prison right off the Forum, known as the Mamertine Prison. Whether or not that is true or can be archaeologically supported is a whole different question. But what is very, very beautiful, and one of the most lovely things, I think you know this because you and I have both lived in Rome for quite a long time, is June 29th, which celebrates the day that the two apostles were taken from their prison. So many paintings of the two embracing for one last time, and Peter marched in the direction that would later become St. Peter's, and St. Paul marched over towards the sea. and he would be executed at the site of the Tre Fontane, which still has a monastery and church on it. And
the Three Fountains.
The Three Fountains.
Why is it called the Three Fountains?
It's a legend. There's wonderful legends around the deaths of the apostles. Mm-hmm. Particularly Paul has a series of magnificent legends surrounding his death. That the head of Paul was beheaded. It's his right as a Roman citizen as well, to a swift death as opposed to Peter, who was going to be crucified. And that Paul was led out, he was bent down, he was beheaded, and his head, when severed, bounced three times. In each place his head bounced, a fountain sprung up. And so this is the site of the Three Fountains.
Which is an actual church now. There,
which is today an actual church on the Laurentina,
mm-hmm,
with three fountains.
Mm-hmm.
Which have, you know, mosaic flooring from an earlier period than when Paul died, but it's still a beautiful place to go and a wonderful place to remember the witness of Paul. And then the body of Paul was taken a few kilometers down, a little ways down, to where the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls is today. Although a section of the skull was removed at some point, again, in the very early era of the relics, you know that the bodies of the apostles were moved around a bit because of persecutions, because of later date, because of other problems. So, for example, in the catacombs of St. Sebastian, there's the room of the apostles where Peter and Paul were allegedly kept together. Their remains were kept together in a safer place. And in the Church of St. John Lateran, the huge reliquary over the main altar, the papal altar of St. John Lateran, the reliquary contains a piece of the skull of Peter and a piece of the skull of Paul. But I trust the rest of Paul will be in the sarcophagus.
Mm-hmm.
You know that the description of the grave of St. Peter comes from a man named Caius, who left us a written description of the grave of St. Peter and says he saw the tombs of St. Peter and St. Paul. And so it's good to know that there is a document. There's a document that dates from about 200 AD, and he was writing a sort of an apologetics, a kind of defensive letter. And in the midst of it, he says, "I can show you the trophies of St. Peter and St. Paul." So we know in 200, before Christianity is legalized, before they're building churches, we already have a document that testifies to veneration of the relics of the martyrs, won out by the Tre Fontane, out by the Ostiense road, and the other one on the Vatican Hill.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture for Duquesne University's Rome campus. Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.